All right. So I'll start off a series of experimental talks this afternoon. And I'm going to talk about searching for light dark matter. So by that, I mean few MeV to few GeV particles using a liquid argon time projection chamber. So all the work I discussed in this talk was done sort of under the umbrella of the DarkSide collaboration. This is sort of a new game for us. We've only recently become involved in trying to lower the threshold of our detector. So what I'm going to do is talk about our current generation experiment and some limits that we've derived using that, and then spend a little bit of time talking about how we can make some improvements and maybe increase sensitivity with future generations of this program. So just so we're all speaking the same language, I'll give you a brief intro of the liquid argon time projection chamber concept. So on the left here is sort of a generic TPC. This happens to be DarkSide 50, but it could be another argon TPC, it could be a xenon TPC. The idea is that you have a volume that is filled with some liquid noble gas, and then you have a pocket at the top of the detector that is filled with, this is liquid filled with gas. And so what happens is you have a particle come in, scatter off of a nucleus or an electron, and it creates some prompt scintillation light. You detect that scintillation light with some photosensors on the top and bottom of the TPC. And you also create some ions. And you drift those ions under a field to the top gas pocket, where you extract them into the gas pocket. And under a even higher field, they scintillate again, and you see a secondary pulse. So we call this prompt pulse the S1 signal, and the second pulse the S2 signal. And this is shown schematically here. So this is time, and this is pulse amplitude. And so you can see there is a first prompt pulse, this is S1, and a pulse sometime later that is S2. And the distance in time between these two pulses is directly related to the z direction, or the z position of that interaction. So it is the drift time between the S1 position and the top of the TPC. In argon, you get another interesting feature, which is that the prompt scintillation, the S1 signal, the time dependence of that signal is dependent on the interaction type, meaning whether it's an electron recoil or a neutron or a nuclear recoil. So on the top, this is an electron recoil, and the bottom is a nuclear recoil. And if you look very closely, you'll see that the electron recoil, the sort of the time profile of this S1 pulse is more extended. So a larger fraction of the light in that S1 pulse happens later in time as compared to the nuclear recoil. And using this fact, you can get a very powerful rejection of electron recoils. So you can do something like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 rejection, depending on how good your overall light collection efficiency is in the experiment. So argon comes with at least one big drawback, and that is argon has a naturally occurring beta-emitting isotope, and this will become important later in the talk. Argon-39 has an endpoint around 556 keV. So this now is an energy spectrum collected with DarkSide 50, and it was collected in sort of two different runs. This first run, shown in black, was made using above ground or atmospheric argon, so argon just collected from the atmosphere. And this has sort of a nominal argon-39 rate of about a becquerel per kilogram. So you can see this large peak from that decay. The second run was done using argon extracted from a deep underground carbon dioxide well, and you can see in that spectrum, which is this red spectrum, the contribution from this argon-39 is barely visible, so you get a reduction of something like 10 to the 3 in argon-39 rate. Now, in general, this is not a problem for sort of the high-mass WIMP searches we do, because, as I said, we have very powerful rejection of electron recoil backgrounds. The problem, though, is if you have a big TPC, the rate is so high that you get a lot of pileup. And so this becomes a problem as you scale from a small TPC to a bigger TPC, and I'll discuss that a bit more going forward. Okay, so as I said, this is all done as part of the DarkSide program. So we have a currently operating detector, DarkSide 50. It's about a 50 kilogram fiducial volume. And now we're talking about scaling up to sort of our next generation detector, which is DarkSide 20K, which is a 20 ton detector. And there will be some intermediate detector, which will, as currently is a mechanical prototype, but I'll discuss potential sort of physics application of this detector going forward. And then there's an eventual sort of long-term plan of some global argon dark matter collaboration, 200-ton giant monolithic detector. But that's a question mark as far as I'm concerned at this point.
Just a quick question.
Yes?
For the WIMP search, do you ever use the S2 to discriminate?
Yeah, so I'll get to... Oh, the S2-S1 ratio? It doesn't really give us anything because the PSD is so powerful, but we do look at it, but we don't. Yeah, it doesn't add anything, I would say. All right, so I'm going to talk about first results from this. then make some general comments about what we can do with these. Okay, so a quick overview of DarkSide 50. So the TPC itself sits inside of a big liquid scintillator Vito, and then that sits inside of a big water shrinkoff detector. And the concept is as follows. The TPC, we can very efficiently remove all of the electron recoil backgrounds that could cause a signal in our region of interest. And so now the thing you worry about is neutrons incident on the TPC. So if you make the TPC effectively transparent to neutrons and place it inside of a highly efficient neutron Vito, you can count all of the neutrons that interact and give you a dark matter-like signal. And so that is what we have done. So this is from a recent 500-day exposure. It was a blind analysis. Now this is so energy on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is F90. So this is this promptness of the light parameter that discriminates between electron recoils and nuclear recoils. So electron recoils all sit in this band, and nuclear recoils sit up here. And you can see this is our signal box, and we open it, and as you expected, there were no events. Now, the thing I'll note here is that DarkSide 50 was really designed for this type of analysis, looking for 100 GeV-ish WIMPs, where this pulse-shaped discrimination is very effective. And what we want to do now is try to push lower in threshold. So this is the exclusion curve you get from this 500-day analysis. It's a little better than like the 5 days of data that Deep released. So they will very quickly release a paper that eclipses us. There may be some collusion that we have a result. They barely beat us, and then we barely beat them, and then they're going to destroy us. I don't know. But clearly you can see that the xenon detectors are much larger and much, much more sensitive than our DarkSide 50 experiment is. Okay, so the question then is, can we take this DarkSide 50 apparatus and reduce the energy threshold, basically in the same way that xenon 10 and xenon 100 have done, to look for both low energy nuclear recoils as well as electron scattering of dark matter particles. And the reason, or the way we're going to do this, so the S1 scintillation signal threshold is about 2 keV electron equivalent, which corresponds to about 10 keV nuclear recoil. So clearly we cannot rely on the S1 signal. Instead, we're going to look at the S2 ionization signal, so that's the electrons that drift up into this gas pocket. And for those, we have a much better threshold. So we can go below 100 eV electron equivalent, which corresponds to something like 400 eV nuclear recoil equivalent. So the first thing we had to do was convince ourselves that we can, in fact, see signal down at these energies. And so what I'm showing here on the x-axis now, this is number of electrons, but you can really think about it as just amount of S2 light for now as a function of event rate. So in light blue are events that have this S1, so the prompt scintillation, and this S2 signal. And in red is S2-only signals, right? So you can see the S1 plus S2 spectrum dies off around 10 keV NR, but this S2-only signal continues down to almost 1 electron. A further interesting thing is, so in black is a spectrum that was collected in the first 100 days of running with this underground argon collected from this carbon dioxide well. And the last little bit of argon that was put in the detector was, instead of being shipped on a barge from the US to Italy, it was shipped on an airplane. So it had some cosmogenic activation of the argon-37 isotope, which has a 35-day half-life, so it wasn't of major concern for overall background, and ends up giving us this nice feature. So we see actually the K shell and L shell lines from the argon-37 electron capture. The K shell is at 2.8 keV, and the L shell is at 270 eV, and we reconstruct these with the correct branching ratio, and we see the decay rate. So this gives us some initial confidence that we can, in fact, see signals down in this energy regime. Now, if we zoom in to this hump here, we can see it's kind of another fortuitous data-taking accident, maybe you'd call it. So there was a period of time where we have a getter that removes electronegative impurities from the argon itself. And there was a period of time when we were doing some maintenance on that, so it was not running. So we had a higher level of impurities in the argon. And that translates to a higher number of single electrons that are trapped and then released at some later time. So basically, we just have a lot more single electrons that we capture during a normal run. So the black points is with the getter on, and the open points are with the getter off. And the thing that you see is this now is a single electron peak, and with the getter off, it increases quite markedly. And on top of that, you also see this corresponding 2-electron peak, which is just basically random pileup of these single electrons. So we can see the single electron peak in this double electron peak with good efficiency, and again, gives us further confidence that we can really do physics down at these low energies. The question was, how do we know the 2-electron peak is pileup? So the rate is consistent with it being some Poisson release of electrons. And actually, that extends, I'll show you later, to 3-4 electron peaks.
So for non-experts, what are the fractional electrons?
Yes. So what we actually detect is not electrons. We detect photons, right, from that S2 light. So there's some correction between. So you get roughly 20 photoelectrons per electron that enters the drift bucket. But of course, there's a wide distribution of that. OK, so we're going to do an analysis where we look only at this S2 ionization signal. It has some advantages. We're in a situation where our PMTs are cold, and so that reduces the dark rate to a level that is negligible for us. And we have a pretty high efficiency. So the center PMT for a single electron extracted from the gas bucket, we see about 23 photoelectrons. So we trigger on that very efficiently. And we can have single electron sensitivity. The big downside now is we lose sort of all of these beneficial features that we had designed dark side 50 around. Specifically, we can no longer do PSD because there is no S1. We can't do Zeke reconstruction anymore because, again, there's no S1, so we can't measure the time difference between the two pulses. And we couldn't even do S2 over S1. So there's a downside in that is effectively you get backgrounds and we don't have a great way to discriminate those backgrounds. So I also put here, just sort of as a matter of orientation, both for myself and for you, a relationship roughly. So all the plots that are about to show, they have varying energy scales. So just try to keep in mind, 1 keV EE is about 5 keV NR. That gives us about 25 electrons, more or less, collected in the gas pocket. And we'd see for that event something like 10 S1 photoelectrons, but 600 ionization photoelectrons. And I should note, these don't scale linearly with one another. So this is just a rough sort of order of magnitude thing to get everyone with the right feel. All right, so now we have to decide or determine, measure what our trigger efficiency is down at these lower energies. So this now is a Monte Carlo simulation that we use to extract our trigger efficiency. So the first thing we do is actually apply a fiducialization to the detector. Now, our usual fiducialization method relies on some sort of more complicated S2 light distribution pattern among those top PMTs. Because we have a lot fewer photoelectrons, we can't do something like that. So instead, we just pick the PMT that has the largest amount of S2 signal. And if it is one of the inner PMTs, we keep the event. If it's one of the outer PMTs, we exclude the event. And this gives us a pretty big hit on efficiency. So we go immediately down to about 44% efficiency. Now you have to add in some trigger efficiency, so the S2 pulses are sort of slower than your average S1 pulse, and as you get down to the sort of 1.5 electron and below level, our trigger efficiency rolls off quite quickly, and we also have some small efficiency for actually identifying the S2 pulse as an S2 pulse. All the analysis I'll talk about happens above 3 or 4 electrons, so very comfortably in the range where the trigger efficiency is high, and sort of the only decrease in efficiency comes from this fiducialization that we do. You can test this fiducialization efficiency quite easily using argon-39, which should be continuously distributed throughout the detector. And so if you just apply this cut to the argon-39 data, you see that the measured reduction in total argon-39 rate is comparable to what you calculate with the simulation. OK, next thing we want to do is try to determine our backgrounds. So the way we're doing that is we fit background data at high energy. And we do this using some constraints based on radio assay measurements. So in green, this is actual measured data. Blue is the sum of all these different contributions from various components that make up the TPC. As you can imagine, a lot of these are redundant. And so you somehow have to constrain them. And we do that based on sort of prior knowledge about what we think the impurities are in a given thing. Cryo is the cryostat.
Ah, so the component.
Yes. Yeah. Cryostat, and then the rest are broken up just into decay. Okay, so now we can take that fit spectrum and extrapolate down to the low energies we're going to care about here. So for now, ignore these blue, orange, and purple curves. So I'll get to those later in the talk. So just try to look at this green line, the red and blue line, and then these data points here. So the data points are the data points, and this black line is the fit from high energy extrapolated down to this low energy region. And you see that, in general, the agreement is quite good. The dominant source of background is PMT gamma rays. Gamma rays that come from the PMTs, as well as the rate from argon 39 and krypton 85, so these beta emitters. So again, sort of get you in a ballpark, on the right axis, this is events per KeV per kilogram day, which is a pretty standard unit used to sort of measure background in these detectors. Now this, so KeVe does not scale linearly with Ne. So this scale is actually correct only at one point, which is 10 Ne. All right, so the number that you should take away from this whole axis is we see about 1.5 events per KeV per kilogram day at this energy regime. And then for the rest of the talk, don't look at that axis again. So 1.5 is the number to think of from here. Now there are two other features that stand out. The first is down at the 1, 2, 3, 4 electron level, we see a big peak. So most of these seem to be time correlated with very large events happening in the TPC. So the thought is you get some electrons that are trapped by some impurity and released at some later time. We can't extend that search out in time indefinitely because we get pileup of events. So we only can sort of correlate roughly 50% of the counts in this region with a larger previous event. It's likely that a larger fraction than 50% are actually due to that process. And then the rest of that fraction, we don't have a good handle on exactly what they're coming from, but they certainly are. And as actually Ruben asked earlier, so these are consistent with Poisson pileup of that single electron band. So we think all of these are explained by single electron noise, essentially. And then we have a second feature down here, which is not explained by the background model. This is not consistent with being random pileup from the single electron peak. And they also, as far as we can tell now, have no correlation with large events preceding them. So we don't have an explanation for what these are either. So just take that at face value, I would say. OK. So now comes the next thing you have to do, which is, so we have our detector. We understand our trigger efficiency. We claim fairly well. We understand our background in the region of interest, except for this excess between 4 and 7 photoelectrons, or sorry, 4 and 7 electrons. So now we have to somehow calibrate the number of electrons to the expected recoil energies that we're looking for. So there are two scales that are important. One is number of electrons to electron recoil, and the other one is number of electrons to nuclear recoil. So getting the electron recoil energy scale is, I would say, the easier of the two. To do this, we rely on data. So we have the K and L shell features that we use to calibrate, and then we can fit basically the origin to these two peaks as well as a high energy krypton peak. And then that gets us a pretty good calibration between number of electrons and electron recoil. The sort of more contentious thing to do is determine the nuclear recoil energy scale. So ideally, you'd like to measure this directly with some sort of standalone calibration experiment or with some kind of nice monoenergetic source in your TPC. Since this was not a priori something we were going to do with our detector, we don't have any of that data. So instead, we're relying on a combination of a Monte Carlo plus two source measurements we did, one with an americium beryllium source and one with an americium carbon source. So let me explain these plots a bit. So what we did was we took a Monte Carlo simulation of these two sources, and then we used this Bezrikov ionization model to simulate the AMB spectrum as well as the AMC spectrum. All right, and then we fit those spectrum to this model to extract two parameters. One parameter is sensitive to the quenching and the recombination, sorry, quenching and the ionization yield, and the other parameter is sensitive to the recombination. The AMB source is nice in that it is coincident with a high energy gamma ray, the neutron, a 4.4 MeV gamma that we can see in our neutron veto and tag fairly efficiently. So you can cut out most background. The problem is that as you go to low energy, the way we trigger the detector is we trigger the veto detectors based on a signal in the TPC. And since we no longer have S1, there is actually quite possibly a long drift time between the S2 event and the corresponding signal in the veto. And so we lose below 50 electrons a lot of the AMB data. So that's why the spectrum has this funky shape. And so because of that, we only fit the spectrum above 50 electrons. The AMC source, we don't have that problem, but we do have a gamma background, which we also have to simulate. So there's downsides to both of them. But we do a simultaneous fit of these two spectra to extrapolate the parameters for our nuclear recoil conversion. Okay, so now this then is a plot so this is the ionization yield as a function of epsilon, which is this reduced energy variable. On the top, you can see the nuclear recoil energy for argon and xenon. And so to make it maximally unreadable, we put argon and xenon on the same plot, and they somehow overlap. So for the purpose of this talk, ignore this line and all of these associated points. We're just going to focus on the things in red. So this red curve is the fit now ionization yield based on the ambient AMC data. And these red points are actual measurements that we've done using some side calibration experiments, this SEEN experiment and this RS experiment. SEEN actually measures S2 and S1, so we are directly measuring ionization yield. RS, unfortunately, only has an S1 signal, so now you have to take that data and use dark side 50 data and calibration points to somehow combine the two, and that is sensitive to some assumptions. So these points can move around a bit relative to one another. I think the takeaway here is that our fit underpredicts versus our measurement. And what we do is we just assign a large systematic error that incorporates both the uncertainties in the fit, and then we expand it to also include the measurements. And so we're trying to, you know, sort of capture our ignorance of what this parameter really is by just including a large systematic on the parameter itself. Okay, so now we can go ahead and calculate what we expect a nuclear recoil spectra to look like in our electron S2 only data. This is a plot you've seen before, but now you can pay attention to these predicted WIMP curves. So this is a 2.5 GeV, 5 GeV, and 10 GeV WIMP. And we use two analysis thresholds. So one at 4 electrons and one up at 7 electrons. So basically one is above this excess. So for higher mass WIMPs, it turns out we get better sensitivity if we exclude this region where we have an excess of signal for background, not so surprisingly. For lower mass WIMPs, we're better off including this region. So that'll become clear when I show you this plot. Okay, so now here are the WIMP exclusion curves we get from these two data sets. There's a kink in both these curves right around the point where you switch from the 4 electron threshold to the 7 electron threshold. Now there are also two curves. So the question you can ask is, why are there two curves? Both in red, so that you can't tell which is which. So these are two assumptions about what the fluctuation on the quenching process is. So we do one fit or one limit extraction where we assume that there is no quenching in the fluctuation, which clearly is not physical, but it's also quite conservative, right? So we're not getting a bunch of signal that's actually below our detector threshold that fluctuates up because we've included some large fluctuation. And then we've done a binomial fluctuation case, which is quite large, right? So the truth probably lives somewhere in the middle of these two curves, but we're not going to know that until we actually go out and explicitly measure this. So we're trying to say, here are two possible reaches for this experiment, but without any knowledge about what this fluctuation should be, we can't really set an actual limit here. Above about 2 GeV, these two curves are more or less insensitive to your choice of quenching model, so we should have both of them. Okay, so that was WIMPs scattering from nuclei, and we can do, using the same data, a search for some more generic dark matter particles scattering off of electrons. So we consider two cases here, much as Oren did this morning. So we have a dark matter form factor of 1, so some velocity independent contact interaction type thing, and then a dark matter form factor that's dependent on the momentum, okay? And so here, instead of using the ionization yield to convert from the predicted spectrum to the expected spectrum, we're just using that fit to the K and L features in the actual data. Yes? Yes, we are. That's another good point. I meant to mention that. Yeah, so in both these cases, we are subtracting that, or we are including in the profile likelihood, that extrapolated background from the high energy fits. So in the case of the nuclear recoil data, certainly, okay, so above 7 electrons, we're sort of dominated by the rate that is not explained. But as you go to higher energy, so basically where these kinks are, that background subtraction does start to help us. For the electron scattering case, most of the signal ends up being just in those first, as you know, few electron bins. And so actually it doesn't make a huge difference whether or not we do the background or include the background in our prophylactic analysis. So these are the limits we extract using those, looking for the dark matter electron scattering. And you can see sort of for the velocity independent form factor, I would say we're sort of comparable to the xenon 10, xenon 100 results. And for the velocity dependent one, we're a bit weaker. I think if we lower our threshold, sort of enter into this region, there was xenon 10 sits, but then we have to contend with a bunch more systematics from our trigger efficiency, et cetera. So we haven't thoroughly done that analysis yet. Okay, so now briefly, I only have like 2 minutes, but I'll say how can we sort of make improvements going forward, both with DarkSide 50 and with these sort of future experiments. And so with DarkSide 50, we're kind of stuck with the backgrounds that we have. What we can try to do is start removing events in this region. And so we can do that first using correlated cuts, so placing some fairly long, I don't know, hundreds of millisecond veto after every large event, exclude events after that. We can also rely on some S2 pattern cut, so if it's a sort of random pileup of single electrons, they should have a different light distribution in the top PMTs than an actual physics event would. We can also start using the veto, so that's not particularly sensitive because we do have this time bullet delay between the S2 signal and the veto signal, but you get some fractional decrease in background using the veto detectors as more than just a passive shield. And we can also try to understand our trigger efficiency down to a single electron by raising the extraction field in the TPC and taking some more data there. So that may give us, you know, some handle on what our real efficiency is down to those lowest electron bins. And then, of course, we can go ahead and mount, you know, a standalone experiment so that we don't have to rely on this Monte Carlo plus neutron source calibration with DarkSide 50 to determine what the ionization yield is of energy. Okay, so then going forward, we can try to make efforts to actually reduce some of these background contributions. And of course, the major ones I mentioned were the gamma rays from the PMTs and the beta spectrum, particularly from argon 39. So ways to do that are, one, with these bigger detectors, we can, of course, fiducialize. So rather than going 5 centimeters in from the edge of our detector, we can go tens, if not meters, of into the detector before we define our sort of fiducial volume. And since we're in a background limited scenario, limiting our exposure doesn't really make much of a difference ultimately. The next thing we can do is use cleaner materials. So as I said, the dominant gamma ray source currently are the PMTs. And for DarkSide 20K, we're switching to using silicon photomultipliers. So this is our latest iteration of a prototype for a silicon photomultiplier-based solution for DarkSide 20K. So this is a 5 by 5 centimeter board that's tiled with silicon PMs, and we read it out as a single monolithic unit. So this is a single channel device, the goal being sort of a direct PMT replacement, meaning we can read out an equivalent area, photosensitive area, to a PMT with a single channel. And this is not a radio pure version of this detector yet, although I would venture to guess if we crush this up and assayed it, we would already be better than a PMT. So that's exciting, and I think will help a lot. The last thing is we can get rid of that argon 39 event rate. So one way to do that is we're building this cryogenic distillation chamber called ARIA in a carbon mine in Sardinia. And so with every pass of argon through this cryogenic distillation chamber, you get about a factor 10 reduction in argon 39. Now, there's some recent evidence that points to the fact that the sort of millibecquerel per kilogram rate of argon 39 we see in DarkSide 50 is not the true intrinsic purity of the argon extracted from the carbon dioxide well. And that is based on measuring the oxygen that is inside the argon. So if you measure the amount of oxygen inside that argon, assume it all comes from atmospheric argon, and then attribute the rate of argon 39 relative to that oxygen ratio, you find that almost all of it is explained by some intrusion of air at some point in the argon extraction process. So it may in fact be based on those assumptions that the argon is another 3 orders of magnitude cleaner than the argon we have in DarkSide 59. So now you're talking about microbecquerel per kilogram, and then you don't need this to begin with. I should also mention, right, so doing this analysis, we've been working in this 100 GeV sort of mass range where we get very good discrimination of everything but neutrons. If we're going to start doing physics down seriously in this lower energy regime, backgrounds that didn't matter before now matter. For example, gamma rays, we can no longer discriminate. And so things like potassium-40, which previously we've just ignored because we can efficiently veto it, that starts to become an issue. So there's a whole sort of range of thinking and optimization that would have to go into making these larger detectors really sort of appropriate for doing this sort of physics. All right, so I'll wrap it up and just say, I think liquid argon TPCs can and have achieved sort of lower energy thresholds that give you sort of competitively low background rates, which give limits that are, you know, interesting both for electron scattering, dark matter scattering off electrons, and dark matter scattering off of nucleons. There are potential incremental improvements possible. We can do a dark side 50. These aren't order of magnitude things. These are factors of a few. But I think for going forward with these larger TPCs, we could really sort of make a order of magnitude leap in or two in sensitivity going forward. So thank you.
Any questions?
Hello. Did you say what your electron extraction efficiency was?
We think it's 100% or 99.9%.
Oh, okay, that's why I missed it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I did not say it, though. You did not miss it.
Hi, so I just wanted to comment on the calibration.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the xenon experiments, we went through a lot of pain to, you know, do measurements at specific energies to map down the curve that you showed.
Yes. Yeah.
And there are many models for the nuclear recoil charge yield that have it drop at lower energies in this nonlinear way. And there's a big difference between showing that your data calibration data is consistent with a flat yield at low energy and actually showing that it really is flat at low energy. So I'm just a little bit skeptical that you can really assume that flat yield. The field is littered with experiments that thought they had a high yield and turned out they didn't, that the yields were lower than Linhart or Bezrikov, and it's just a complicated business.
Yeah, so, no, I tend to agree with you on that point. Yes.
I prefer a philosophy where we don't claim a limit unless we actually have a direct measurement of the yields.
Yes, that point is well taken, and I think shared among people also within the argon or in the dark side collaboration. Yeah, no, I mean, you are right. I don't argue with that comment.
So I was wondering if you've seen the archive article that Ben Jones put up at the end of March, which says that you can actually get TPB in the argon, that the argon picks up the TPB.
Oh, no, I hadn't seen that.
And he looks at foils, he looks at a lot of different kinds of materials that are coating it. And I was wondering if you were seeing any kind of time dependence associated with your argon, and if you had a way of actually testing whether there's any TPB in the argon. I think what we're going to do in Microboon is we're going to try to get some argon and run it through a mass spec to find out what's actually in it.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. We haven't looked for that. It is certainly true that, we're fairly certain there are parts of the TPC where the TPB has been washed away, sort of.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Right. So there's an inlet argon port, uh-huh. And if you do an XY reconstruction map for some subset of events near where presumably that argon comes in, you see some slightly lower light yield, pointing to the fact that maybe there's some missing TPB.
Okay, we should talk then, because this is going to have huge implications for when you try to make larger detectors that have foils on them,
sure.
Which is not just what you all are trying to do, but also what we want to do also at Fermilab.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. One over here.
So in these exclusion plots, you always show the sensitivity versus mass. But I was wondering, do you have an idea of what the mass resolution would be once you find something?
So for this type of analysis, using the electron recoil or the electron extract electron signal, the discovery probability is much, or sensitivity is much lower than our exclusion sensitivity. And without a good handle on the background, it would be very hard to make any sort of discovery claim with this experiment. I mean, the best shot you have would be some annual modulation thing. That's sort of, you know, at the higher masses, that's one of our selling points, is that we have a background-free experiment. We understand our background very well, and you could actually make some sort of discovery claim with only a few events. For this sort of stuff, it's very hard, in my opinion.
So about this excess that you've shown, probably you thought about it, but did you consider this like photoionization, for example, of the grids or other materials?
I think all those things are still on the table. We haven't dug into it in any great depth.
Then I have another question that's not related. So because you have this neutron veto, you also measure, as you said, the intrinsic, like the regenerating neutron background, right? And is that what you predict by Monte Carlo? I mean, did you compare it to the prediction?
Yeah, we have compared it. And actually, we measure fewer neutrons than our Monte Carlo predicts. So the reason why is not actually immediately clear.
Well, maybe because the Monte Carlo, because you have some of the values that you put in are maybe upper limits. I don't know.
Well, so actually, I think the problem is really with the alpha N cross-section, or the alpha N yield that we calculate.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, so if you measure, say, a piece of ceramic, it has some intrinsic radio purity, the actual position of that impurity within a composite material makes a big difference about what your alpha N yield is.
Yeah.
So we're really dominated by uncertainty in that. Mm-hmm. And so we're off by a factor of a few. And
okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's a hard simulation to do, ultimately.
We've been doing a whole lot of alpha N calculations recently, and actually we're finding that sometimes they just veto themselves anyway because they come with a gamma. Then we just don't. I don't know. You simulate just the neutrons on their own?
No, we do. We simulate the whole entire expected signal in the veto.
Well, even I mean, coincident gammas with alpha N, though.
Yeah, we are also looking at that.
We're finding that it's very hard. Thin versus thick yield, and all this is really big uncertainties. So.
Yeah. Right. So there is something to be said for actually being able to see them in your video. Yeah.
So I just have a very quick question on your high energy background spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
So you think you had uranium from, I think, the up and low, maybe? Or is it low and, is that the PMTs, top and bottom array, or?
That's the chain, upper chain and lower chain.
Oh, array. Okay.
So and it's summed over all of the different upper chain contributions from different.
Just components. Used to early and late, though.
Yeah, gotcha.
Okay. Oh, we've got one more question.
Does the potassium 40 have the doubly forbidden decay chain thing? So something you guys did a long time ago. That was for Dhamma that you talked about it possibly being important. Is that something that could show up in? I just noticed that was kind of high.
Yeah, so this is, these are the gamma rays primarily. So these are at 1,000 keV. That would be a much subdominant to the major background radio.
Okay, if there's no more questions, then let's thank Graham again.
Thanks.